you're doing.
So I have an incredibly cool job. I've been at Microsoft for, next week it's going to be 16 years. And I spent my first 8.5 years in a variety of different product groups. I started as a developer and went up through sort of the management chain there for a little while. Crossed over to the dark side and became a program manager. Did that for a time too. Came over to Microsoft Research about 7.5 years ago to start out working in our speech group to figure out a productization strategy for that. And so we now have a speech product group. And sort of branched out from there to look at other kinds of tech transfer. How we can get a whole bunch of our other research technologies into our product groups. And that was sort of a fun experience because I spent a lot of time talking to customers and talking about Microsoft Research because a lot of our customers really want to find out what's going on with Microsoft Research and what they're going to see come out of that. And they want to know where the future of computing is going. And the most common question I get is, what is your technology transfer process? And it's almost always accompanied by this really pained expression on people's faces. You can just tell they've been through like wars inside their company trying to make this work. And so I started poking at their mental model. I found out that most people think that technology transfer is some sort of Rube Goldberg machine, right? Where technology goes in one side, weird things happen in the middle, kind of put people in contorted positions, and it's just supposed to magically pop out on the other side. And it never works that way, because technology transfer, when it works, isn't some kind of logistical, mechanical, turn-the-crank process. It's a social process. It's about relationships, communication, and trust. And so I said, all right, I'm just going to embrace that. I'm going to build a team of program managers up here to make tech transfer happen out of Microsoft Research. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to go find the best relationship managers that I possibly can, bring them in, and say, it's your job to go build the best relationships you possibly can, personal relationships between people in our product groups and researchers in Microsoft Research. We'll teach them to talk to each other because, they live in different roles and speak different languages and don't really understand each other.
You're across the freeway from the main campus, right?
That's right.
That's a whole different world.
and I know that because I was over there for 8 years. So we'll teach them to talk to each other. We'll teach them to understand each other and communicate with each other and build a trust between each other out of that. And we'll do this as an act of faith. If we can actually build that kind of relationship, the tech transfer will take care of itself. They're smart people. They'll figure out, once they realize they have the same goal, they'll figure out how to make it work. And it's been stunningly successful for us. We just, at this point, essentially every single Microsoft product has research technology in it. And our development processes, there's mandatory use of tools that have come out of our Programmer Productivity Research Center. They're mandatory use by all our product groups. And now we're actually, it's great because we're seeing them go into WIDBI, into the enterprise toolkit.
Yeah, the compiler that came out of research that's in WIDBI, right?
Yeah, and some of the other tools around test prioritization and static analysis of code came out of Microsoft Research, and we're just thrilled by that. So beyond that, the tech transfer group is still a group I own. I own a couple other groups. I own University Relations. I own the group that helps build partnerships between Microsoft Research and both research faculty and teaching faculty in academia to find the places where interests align, make sure that we can make it easier to do research and great research, make it easier to teach better classes because, on both fronts, there's just so much more that we could be doing together. And particularly on the curriculum side, I think about trustworthy computing curriculum all the time. So many of us working here and in the rest of industry and academia, have computer science degrees, and how many of us were ever taught what a buffer overflow is, right?
Or threat model.
Threat modeling is a fairly advanced, you could spend, an entire course just thinking about that and all the issues around it. But just buffer overflows. We should be teaching that in every single introductory programming course. Right? We just should, because the reality today is everybody needs to know that. Right? So
that's not a Microsoft problem either.
It's not a Microsoft problem. This is everybody's problem. Yeah. Right? And it's academia's problem as much as it's our problem. So, we've got University Relations Organization, and then I have an external communications organization that talks to customers and press a little bit and manages our website. And you may have noticed that we did a little relaunch of our website last week with not only a cleaner interface, and we improved the functionality of our search functionality on the website, but we also have 3 RSS feeds.
Yay.
And yay, and my hope is we'll actually have some more shortly. And it's always one of those things where I don't just want to create RSS feeds and then have no content appearing on them. So part of the discipline I'm doing with my team is, look, let's, before we launch a new RSS feed, let's make sure we have a plan for the content that we want to put on. Make sure it's something that people are going to be interested in, and we can actually keep it up, and we can sustain it over a long period of time. So we're working through plans. You know, I think there are a lot of people I hear all the time more people that are really interested in knowing what we're doing in our university relations organization. So I'd like to create an RSS feed around that, but I really want to make sure that the team knows how to support that and sustain it over a period of time before we go do that.
What is research? When you're out, when I was down in Silicon Valley, I'd read these press reports, you know, Bill Gates to increase spending on research by $1 billion or whatever.
Yeah. So
what is
actually
research,
So let me fill in a couple pieces of this. There's, we're spending in fiscal year 4, which is just about to end here, about $6.9 billion in research and development in Microsoft. And that's all of our product development and Microsoft Research. Microsoft Research is the R in R&D, and it's a very small, relatively speaking, fraction of that whole $6.9 billion. But, you know, in terms of how do you define the two of them, what's the development side, what's the research side, I actually think it helps to sort of contrast them with each other because, you know, our product development groups are engineering groups. They, like other product development groups around the world, in order to go build the product, they have to be able to spec it, and they have to be able to schedule it. That means they pretty much have to know how to go build something, right? You can write a spec for a feature, but then you have to figure out, how long is it really going to take me to build this thing? And what kind of skills and knowledge and background and algorithms do I need to, before you can even sort of estimate it's going to take me this long to do it? So if they don't know how to build something, nobody in the team, you know, even if it may be something nobody's ever built before, but if they can at least estimate how it's going to be built, they're not going to, you know, write it into the product plans. Research is just the opposite. If somebody actually knows how to build something, that's not a research problem, right? We only go after the things that nobody knows how to do. And in fact, a lot of people probably tell you, oh, you can't do that. It's impossible. It just can't be done, right? Those are research challenges, right? And so you actually hire differently for that. You go hire people who have a track record of doing research, of going after problems that nobody's ever solved and solving them, and then publishing the results, you know, in peer-reviewed journals so that other...
How do you come up with the problem?
Well, we actually for us, there's two parts. There's one, tracking what's going on in the larger research community, because honestly, we're not going to solve all the problems in computer science ourselves, right? And we, as much as everybody else, needs a larger research community to vet each other's ideas and make sure, you know, that we're being honest about this, because it's really easy to sort of hide off on your own and convince yourself you're doing great research, but until you actually have a set of peers who are giving you feedback and saying, no, that's good research, that's bad research, you don't really know. So we listen to that a lot and see sort of where the research community believes the research agenda is at. But once again, it comes back to these relationships that we're building with our product groups, right? We listen to our product groups. They're really the expert on Microsoft customers. We spend a little time talking to customers. They spend a ton of time talking to customers and getting fantastic information. And so the conversations that we have with them, in a lot of ways, tend to boil down to, so what are the technology problems that you don't know how to solve today that if you knew how to solve would be a huge benefit for your customers? We have to phrase it that way so that, you know, we don't end up being, you know, all the features that fell off their priority list for the next version of the product.
Right.
Right. We really have to, you know, focus on the distinction of we work in the research, you guys actually do the engineering part. If this feature is important enough to our customers, it gets prioritized higher and it gets into the product. Right. Or some other product gets downsized so that we can move resources on this one because that's where the priorities are. Now, that's part of the business of running a development group, and we let them do that, and we try not to interfere with them doing that. We try to really focus on what's the right investment in terms of the places where we just have to go solve our problems, whether it's speech or vision or, you know, new kinds of devices, large, you know, large displays and interaction methods with those, Working with rich media, video and audio, and that whole set of things.
How much of research is just trying to predict where the trends of hardware are going to be and trying to predict what people are going to use that new hardware coming up? We're starting to hear about flexible screens, we're seeing camera phone adoption being, how much of research is just looking at where the next 5 years or 10 years are going to be and trying to guess what the best big problems are there?
Well, it's funny because there's a set of those trends that are almost predefined, things like Moore's Law. We know that for at least the next 20 years, the power of computation that's going to be available to us is going to double every about 18 months, 12 to 18 months, right? That's going to continue on for a long period of time. Storage, we've seen just an incredible explosion of cheap storage. Displays, you mentioned something, and you can plot out and see very clearly where the trends are going. So then, on the research side, what we say is, okay, in 24, 36 months, here's the kind of machine you can expect to have. What could you do with that sort of machine, right? Imagine how much data will you really have? What will searching be like then? What will it be like to search through terabytes of data? One of the jokes I like to make with folks is, if disk space is really that cheap as it is now, why would we ever throw anything away? Well, lawyers aside, I'm sure there's a great Enron Anderson joke in there somewhere. People aren't throwing things away, right? They're keeping all this stuff. In fact, we have research projects in sort of the extreme of that. We have a project run by Gordon Bell down in our San Francisco lab called My Life Bits, which just says, I'm just not going to throw it. In fact, all that stuff that's been, in the physical world for... Jim Gray works a little bit on that project. But it's really Gordon's baby. And the notion is, I'm going to take all my documents, all my photos, and everything I've collected through my life, put it all online. And by the way, all the new stuff I create, I keep online. And then what kind of interface do I need to search through all that and navigate it and literally go try to find things? How do I index all of that? Because, it can be literally very easily terabytes of data. And that's a sort of scale on a personal level. Clearly companies are dealing with terabytes. Some of them are even dealing with, petabytes of data now. But on a personal level, to have terabytes of data, it's a stunning thing for us to try to deal with. And just to sort of set a context, in terabyte of disk space, you can have an audio recording of your entire life. If you multiply that by 1,000, in a petabyte of data, you can have a video recording of your entire life.